That's Linda Sarsour. Thank you for joining us, leading activist here in New York. Jeffrey Sachs, professor at Columbia University, head of the Center for Sustainable Development, author of the new book, Building the New American Economy, Smart, Fair, and Sustainable. I want to thank Bill Hartung for joining us, as well as Ola Ojuwumi, who was in the room yesterday, and Professor Kelly Lytle Hernandez from Los Angeles at UCLA. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Thanks so much for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura. Offbeat sounds for talented listeners. Broadcasts every other Wednesday at 10 p.m.
There was heaven and there was earth.
Después de esa pieza, vamos a escuchar una comunicación simpática y cruel con alguien.
That's Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura, every other Wednesday from 10 to midnight, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. Coming up next, we have KBOO Evening News. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, this spring, Portlanders will be asked to vote on the largest bond in state history.
Oregon's congressional delegation reacts to last night's speech by President Trump.
A new study finds Portland the fifth fastest-changing city in the country.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 1st, 2017. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. The largest bond in Oregon history, $790 million, will go before voters in May to fund construction and repairs in Portland schools. Yesterday, the Portland School Board voted unanimously to put the bond on the ballot. If passed, it would fund the remodeling of Benson and Madison High Schools, demolition and new construction at Lincoln High and Kellogg Middle School, and fixes to safety hazards, including plumbing, in nearly every Portland school. The state will kick in $8 million in matching funds if the bond passes. The district had planned to put a bond on November's ballot due to high voter turnout for a presidential election, but revelations of lead-tainted drinking water in May caused the school board to wait. If passed, property owners will pay $1.40 for every $1,000 of assessed value. The owner of a home assessed at $250,000, for example, would pay an additional $350 per year.
According to a study from the Associated Press, Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents made traffic stops in Woodburn, Oregon, resulting in the arrest of 10 people. Federal officers stopped two vans carrying 19 workers and took 10 of them away, according to Pedro Sosa of the American Friends Service Committee, a Quaker organization. The workers were on their way to an Oregon forest to pick ornamental shrubs. According to ICE representatives, seven of the 10 remain in custody and efforts are underway to deport them. ICE activity has ramped up nationwide since President Trump removed their restraints. In Oregon, ICE teams seem to be focusing on the Woodburn area, a predominantly Latino town between Portland and Salem.
A large crowd interrupted today's city council meeting following a statement by the mother of 17-year-old Quinnis Haynes, who was killed by the Portland police earlier this month. The Portland police's system of policing has been a long-time issue for the city, leading to an investigation from the Department of Justice back in 2012, which ultimately led to a settlement agreement. The city's response has been heavily criticized by advocates for police reform, as well as by the families and communities who condemn the police's excessive use of force against marginalized communities. KBOO reporter Jenna Yokoyama brings us more from today's City Council meeting.
Today's Portland City Council meeting had a packed chamber as the mother of Quinnis Haynes gave a statement to Mayor Wheeler and the commissioners in attendance. Haynes is a 17-year-old teenager who was killed by Portland police on February 9th of this year.
My name is Venus Haynes, and I'm the mother of Quinnis Haynes, the 17-year-old that was shot and killed by Officer Andrew Hurst on February 9th. I would like to thank all for gathering here today, both in remembrance for my son, Quinnis Haynes, and in support of my family's fight for justice on his behalf. It's been 20 days since Quinnis was taken from me. The days passing, his death felt like a lifetime for my family. Myself, for my family and myself, we waited patiently for the city, its officials, to provide us answers surrounding the events that took my son's life. As the details are slowly made available to the public, my family has had the better burden of piecing together what occurred by fact-finding statements given in various social media sites and news outlets, rather than receiving them from those working this investigation. Since his death, we have learned that Officer Hurst, who was also involved in the death of Merrill Hatch, shot Quinnis a total of 3 times. To clarify earlier statements and news reports, my son died immediately as a result of a gunshot wound to his head. My son was born and raised in Portland. Quinnis was not a thug or a gang member or some homeless street kid. He was a funny, adventurous teen who, like most kids, at times can be a little rebellious. He was my child. His life mattered. And I want to know why he was killed. I'm asking the public to stand with my family and me as we seek answers. I am asking the public to stand by us as we demand justice. Let my son's life be the means of change. We ask again any witnesses of the events leading up to Quinnis' death to reach out to our family's attorney, Ashley Albies, the Portland police, your local pastor, or any of the many advocacy groups in Portland. Thank you. We have no more just statements at this time.
Members of the group Don't Shoot Portland were in attendance to support Haynes and her family, many holding signs with a picture of Quinnis. Supporters of Quinnis Haynes interrupted the meeting, followed by the statement by Haynes' mother with rallying chants. Mayor Wheeler called for a recess, during which time the family of Quinnis Haynes, along with Mayor Wheeler, answered questions from the press. Don't Shoot Portland organizer Teresa Rayford says the group will continue to advocate for the Haynes family.
We're just going to work with the direction of the family and anything that they need or want from us in regards to demonstrations, actions, activism. We're already on board. We're just going to go ahead and just make sure that each demand and each demonstration that there's follow-up involved, because right now we know that we're waiting for the grand jury to take place, but we want to make sure that there's a lot of transparency in that process and hopefully an indictment before it even happens, because that would make sense, you know, especially in this case.
For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jenna Yokoyama.
A new report has listed Portland as the fifth fastest changing city in the U.S. The report, which was prepared by LendingTree, the online lending company, compared almost 1,200 American cities using data from a wide variety of business sources and the U.S. Census Bureau. The city's only top 10 ranking was in the category measuring the increase of home prices, but according to the report, Portland experienced more change in more other factors than the majority of other cities. In particular, The city ranked well above average in the rent change score, the home value score, and the foreclosure score, and was above average in the business growth score. Perhaps not surprisingly, the only score where the city was below average was in the area of diversity.
Declaring a safety emergency, the Portland City Council will vote Thursday on the proposal to lower the speed limit from 35 to 30 miles per hour on a 4.5-mile stretch of Southeast Division from 82nd Avenue to the city border. Commissioner Dan Saltzman, who oversees the city's Transportation Bureau, said, "We're doing this because Division really is a death corridor. Five people died in traffic crashes on Outer Division Street in 2016, a year that saw 44 traffic fatalities citywide, the most since 2003. The Oregon Department of Transportation usually has jurisdiction over speed limits, but Portland plans to invoke a state law that allows for a 120-day emergency speed limit."
An early morning house fire in Riddle, 23 miles south of Roseburg, killed several people and sent others to the hospital with serious burns and other injuries. Details on those taken to Legacy Emmanuel Medical Center in Northeast Portland were not provided. Fire departments from Riddle and Tri-City, which are between Roseburg and Grants Pass along I-5, responded. County and state officials are investigating the fire.
Earlier today, Republican leaders and media analysts praised Donald Trump for behaving presidentially and delivering his best speech yet to the joint sessions of Congress last night. But though the tone may have changed, the message really hasn't. At least that's the reaction from most of Oregon's congressional delegation. Senator Jeff Merkley commented that the speech still sounded like a campaign speech, lacking details. Merkley said, quote, "The American people deserve answers. They deserve to know the details of Donald Trump's plans and how he intends to pay for his programs." Senator Ron Wyden expressed concern about Trump's continuing commitment to the repeal and replacement of the Affordable Care Act. Wyden said, quote, "Tonight, the president continued to use health care happy talk, despite the fact that congressional Republicans are dangerously close to taking America back to the days when health care was only for the healthy and wealthy." Not surprisingly, Oregon's lone Republican, Representative Greg Walden, endorsed the president. He called the speech refreshingly optimistic and focused on the president's commitment to job growth. But perhaps the response that resonated the best with Portlanders came from Representative Earl Blumenauer. He simply said, quote, "Resist."
In his address to Congress last night, President Trump said construction will soon begin on what he calls a great, great wall along our southern border. The Trump administration has opened up bids for the project, and companies have until next Friday to submit their design concepts. KQED's John Sepulveda has this report.
This is the California Report. Good morning to you. I'm John Sepulveda, and we begin at the U.S. Capitol. That's where President Donald Trump gave his first address to a joint session of Congress last night. The president made or reaffirmed about two dozen promises in the speech, including this one.
"We will soon begin the construction of a great, great wall along our southern border."
The Trump administration has opened up bids for the project, and companies will have until next Friday to submit their design concepts. So far, there's no price tag on how much the wall would cost. There's already a 21-foot metal border fence between California and Mexico for the vast majority of the border. The cost of the current fence per mile is $85 million over the next 25 years.
About one-third of the 2,000-mile-long border with Mexico has already been fortified. To complete the job could cost as much as $21.6 billion. And take more than 3 years, according to estimates by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security.
In his speech before a joint session of Congress Tuesday night, President Donald Trump kept immigration enforcement front and center, framing it as a law and order approach. FSRN's Nell Abram has more.
President Trump wove immigration through his speech, tying the issue to unemployment and depressed wages, to drugs, and to taxes. He vowed that work will soon begin to greatly expand the wall along the country's border with Mexico. But when he tied immigration to a new government agency to support victims of violent crime, he drew audible gasps from the audience.
"And we must support the victims of crime. I have ordered the Department of Homeland Security to create an office to serve American victims. The office is called VOICE, Victims of Immigration Crime Engagement. We are providing a voice to those who have been ignored by our media and silenced by special interests."
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jose Antonio Vargas is founder and CEO of Define American. He was one of the undocumented immigrants in attendance in the House chamber of the United States Capitol during the speech.
This is a new office that in some ways is going to make ICE agents out of any person in America who feels maybe attacked, fearful, or whatever way they feel about the undocumented people or the people that they perceive to be undocumented in their communities.
In a memo announcing the new office, DHS Secretary John Kelly ordered ICE to immediately divert all money, quote, currently used to advocate on behalf of undocumented immigrants to fund the new office. Trump also called for immigration reform. But rather than expand visa opportunities for low-skilled workers to find work legally, he suggested adopting a merit-based immigration system. If recently introduced legislation known as the RAISE Act is any indication, the type of reform the president is advocating will come at the expense of family chain migration, in which legal immigrants are able to sponsor visas for close relatives. Marta Zavala-Perez is a college professor and a beneficiary of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. She says that the so-called merit-based system inherently locks out people who are undocumented, with the exception of DACA recipients who are able to establish legally permitted work histories.
We need to deal with facts. It's very easy to say, we'll just do it the right way. Yep. What is the right way? Because if you actually look at immigration law, there is no legal way to enter this country at this point. There is no way for my mother, for my father, to search for a future in this country. And that's not because they don't want to. That's not because they don't contribute. That is because the current law, the current framework, does not allow for it.
Perez is among a growing number of DACA recipients who choose to use their quasi-legal status to speak out on behalf of immigrants without authorization. The RAISE Act, formerly called the Reforming American Immigration for Strong Employment Act, was introduced in the Senate earlier this month. The measure redefines close relatives as children and spouse only, removing provisions for parents. It also caps the number of refugees the president can admit to the country in any given year at 50,000 and eliminates the diversity visa program, under which people from countries with historically low levels of immigration could legally enter the United States. For FSRN, I'm Nell Abram.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for news from the BOO at 5:45, followed at 6 o'clock by Kitchen Table Conversations, a spontaneous live talk radio program focused on important events. At 7 o'clock, it's Keeping It Real, a public affairs talk radio program emphasizing a youth perspective. Tomorrow's weather calls for a cloudy morning, giving way to an afternoon of showers. Temperatures will be in the upper 40s. East of the Cascades and Hood River, you can expect a cloudy day with temperatures hovering around 50 degrees. On this date in 1961, newly elected President John F. Kennedy issued the executive order that established the Peace Corps. Today's quote is from Sergeant Shriver, the first director of the Peace Corps, who said, quote, "Any idealist who tries to join the Peace Corps must realize that he is not going to change the world overnight."
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael welcomes the new month, but which one?
Part of me wishes it was a month later. So after the usual stream of shocking, depressing news, the anchor would shout, "April Fools!" Part of me doesn't want to miss a day, as individual life always has sparkling moments. As in a world so full of manure, I know there must be a pony for me hidden somewhere. We march on. We persist, make music, hold hands, lean way over the bridge railing, and don't jump. The year's pendulum is swinging, longer, warmer days, crocuses and daffodils showing their brilliant heads. Think of this breath as the best drink you've ever tasted, exciting every part of you that can get there. It's a big bottle, still nearly full. For poetic justice, This is Dan Raphael.
Thursday marks the first anniversary of the murder of the prominent environmentalist and indigenous rights activist Berta Cáceres in Honduras. The crime has sparked international condemnation and a reconsideration of U.S. military aid to that country. While the investigation into Cáceres' murder is ongoing, many believe the motive was linked to her high-profile activism and leadership of COPIN, the Civic Council of Popular and Indigenous Organizations of Honduras. To reflect on what's transpired since Berta Cáceres' death, FSRN's Shannon Young spoke with her nephew, Silvio Carrillo, an award-winning freelance journalist and documentary filmmaker.
First, let's start with the status of the investigation into your aunt's murder. What's been uncovered thus far, and what does your family think about the official investigation?
It's been a completely bungled investigation by the Honduran authorities. That as soon as it happened, they went into the house, they destroyed evidence, they stomped all over the house. There was people who were unknown to us and to them that in the house. And then they held the main witness. They didn't let him clean up. He had blood all over his clothing. They held him, questioned him for about 36 to 48 hours, and didn't give him any legal representation. And it was. And then there was rumors that they started, that the police themselves started, talking to the media and saying that this was a crime of passion, and then later on that it was a robbery attempt, and then, you know, like a myriad of things to create this confusion that really, I mean, we all know the truth, and this was, you know, we now know that some of the people arrested belonged to and worked for DESA, the company that was building the dam, and the links go higher up because some of these men were also in the army and part of intelligence, Honduran intelligence, of the army that was trained by the U.S. So it's, you know, this is a never-ending story, but it's clearly not an appropriate, that the Honduran authorities are not the appropriate people to be conducting this kind of authority, especially in a country with a 95% impunity rate, which means that only 5% of the crimes get solved. So in such a high-profile murder, how is this government, in reality, going to solve this crime? They don't have the capability nor the wherewithal to do so, considering they may be linked.
The military men who have been arrested as part of this case, the information about their backgrounds and U.S. training, has that been more of an investigation by the family, or has it been communicated by the government?
The government has not been communicating with us. My grandmother, poor woman, has to stand by the radio every day and listen for news of the murder. What's happened is some of this information has been leaked, conveniently leaked, and through pro-government media outlets. And then we know some of these people that have worked there. They have been run-ins with them from before, that my aunt has had threats from them, from some of them. So she's familiar with these and has lodged complaints against a few of these men. So these guys are familiar to us. We knew their backgrounds already. A lot of this is not new for us, except for the random people, the other gentlemen that they arrested. And so, but we still don't believe that these are the criminal masterminds, the people that paid for this murder, although the U.S. Embassy here in Honduras is saying it is. There's no way that's true, because these links clearly go up higher into the Army and into Army intelligence, which would lead you to the government itself.
Global Witness describes Honduras as the deadliest country in the world for land defenders. What factors drive this, and who specifically are the victims?
Well, the factors, I mean, yeah, this is going on around the world, and unfortunately Honduras has become a focal point for it, because with the help of the U.S., Honduras has quote-unquote opened up for business. And so the oligarchy here, the business interests, which are aligned with the National Party and the current government, and the government since the coup in 2009 that the U.S. supported, have simply just said, all right, well, you know, we're going to bring in all this money, and we're just going to take all these lands, and we're going to create mines and dams and energy projects that really aren't necessary or even that efficient for Honduras in this time and place. Like, there are many other ways to invest in these lands or invest in electricity and power for Honduras. But they chose to do this because it's basically a get-rich-quick scheme for the establishment. So the victims are, you know, the rest of us who are these poor people who don't have land, who aren't educated, who don't have water, and the price is the life of leaders in places like Honduras, where we don't have leaders to look up to. Like, little boys and girls in Honduras have no heroes here. They just assassinated one. You know, that's what the U.S. should be doing, is helping to foster more and more heroes, like this woman who had created a movement, and clearly it had an impact worldwide.
As you mentioned, the violence targeting land defenders in Honduras has been parallel to a rise in U.S. military aid to the country's government and to outright presence of U.S. military personnel. The former head of U.S. Southern Command, the military office that oversees Pentagon operations in Latin America and the Caribbean, is now the Secretary of Homeland Security. Do you see a risk of certain aspects of the militarized war on drugs coming to the U.S.?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's already been happening. You know, previous to this, we see militarized police forces in small towns all over the U.S., and they're cracking down on protesters, and it seems, you know, it's really scary to be talking about this in a place, you know, you kind of expect it here, but not in the U.S., and lo and behold, it's starting to happen in the U.S. a lot and very frequently. Last year was a horrible year for these kinds of incidents, and you know, I expect with this current administration, with this heightened fear mongering, I think it'll continue, of course, and I think the current administration almost seems to take pleasure in creating chaos, and sadly, I think the police and the military are obviously going to be getting a big boost in financing.
Silvio Carrillo, anything else you'd like to add?
I also wanted to add that my aunt Petita, Tia Tita, as I called her, was of course, you know, this very large presence, this woman that you had to listen to when she spoke. But also, Berta was a mother. You know, she was a mother to four children. She was a daughter. She was an aunt, and she was like a sister to me. We were only 2 years apart, and so she's not just this figure that is now, you know, gone. She was a human being. You know, she could have been anybody's aunt. She could have been anybody's daughter or sister. But she was just fighting for survival and trying to help do what's right. It's not just about politics or you know, whatever. It's about what it is to be human.
Silvio Carrillo is a freelance journalist and filmmaker who lives in Oakland, California. He joined us by phone from the family hometown of La Esperanza, Honduras. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imnc.org for Tuesday, February 28, 2017. A Palestinian worker died while being chased by Israeli soldiers. In the meantime, troops invade West Bank communities and attack civilians. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Palestinian medical sources have reported that a young Palestinian man was killed early at dawn on Tuesday after falling into a deep quarry when Israeli soldiers chased him and other workers while trying to enter Israel for work without permits. The sources stated that Rabia Najih Salman, 20, is from Askar refugee camp in the northern West Bank district of Nablus. Eyewitnesses said that soldiers chased many Palestinian workers west of Salfit in central West Bank, especially as they climbed the annexation wall near the Azawiya village west of the city. The Palestinian then fell into a stone masonry quarry that was approximately 50 meters high. Palestinian medics rushed to the scene after receiving a call of the incident, but the young man died from the fall and was officially pronounced dead before the ambulance even reached Rafidia Governmental Hospital in Nablus. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers abducted on Tuesday at dawn two Palestinians from their homes in Jerusalem and Tobas in the occupied West Bank and summoned six Palestinians from Jenin for interrogation. Moreover, Israeli troops invaded on Tuesday the town of Beit Fajar, south of the West Bank city of Bethlehem, searched homes and abducted a Palestinian man from his home. Later on Tuesday evening, soldiers invaded the town of Beit Umar, north of Hebron, in the southern part of the occupied West Bank and abducted two children. Also on Tuesday, escorted by Israeli police, a group of extremist Israeli settlers again stormed the courtyards of Al-Aqsa Mosque. Prayers and students who were present tried to prevent the settlers from invading the courtyards, but to no avail. According to local sources, Israeli settlers invade Al-Aqsa Mosque on an almost daily basis, seeking to divide the third holiest site for Muslims worldwide. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was a Tuesday, February 28, 2017, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Doris Maui and me, Ressam Bannoura.
After a weeks-long blockade of eastern provinces by Ukrainian nationalists, Russian-backed rebels and insurgents are taking over scores of factories and mines in those provinces. The blockade has raised the already high tensions in Ukraine, where a war between government forces and separatists has killed more than 9,800 people in eastern Ukraine since April of 2014. A recent surge in fighting, the blockade, and Russia's decision last month to recognize passports and other documents issued by the pro-Russian separatists have threatened the goal of reintegrating the rebel-held regions back into the Ukraine. The Ukrainian government has spoken against the blockade, saying it hurts ordinary Ukrainians in the rest of the country, but has taken no action to break it, fearing to challenge the nationalist groups.
President Trump has threatened that he will withhold federal funds from sanctuary cities that don't cooperate with his immigration enforcement policies. Bill Newman of the American Civil Liberties Union has this report.
Can Trump federalize your local police department and force your police officers to act as ICE agents? I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. Trump is demanding the power to federalize your local police and threatening municipalities that won't acquiesce with taking away the federal money that comes to your city or town. The problem with Trump's threat, one problem, is that it's unconstitutional. Municipalities have the right to serve and protect all members of their community, the right to direct local law enforcement to not investigate, arrest, or hold people solely because of their immigration status. In 1997, the Supreme Court struck down a provision of the federal Brady Handgun Violence Prevention Act because it required local law enforcement officers to enforce federal gun control laws by conducting background checks. The Supreme Court decision, written by Justice Scalia, said no, the federal government cannot commandeer local police. Similarly, in 2012, the Supreme Court struck down a provision of the Affordable Care Act that required states to expand their Medicaid program or lose federal Medicaid money. Again, the court found that the provision was unduly coercive, and that's why Trump cannot force local law enforcement to work for ICE, at least as long as the Constitution remains a bulwark against the exercise of arbitrary power. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU, because freedom can't protect itself.
We hear Rick Smith with Labor History in 2 minutes, followed by a report from Doug Cunningham of LaborRadio.org on the pending staff reductions at the Environmental Protection Agency.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1936. That was the day Hoover Dam was formally turned over to the federal government. It was a massive undertaking. Approved by the Coolidge administration in 1928, work began to divert and then dam the Colorado River in 1931, creating Lake Mead. Thousands of unemployed flocked to the area in search of jobs. More than 21,000 were employed over the course of 5 years, with as many as 5,200 working on any given day. Workers were paid on average of 50 cents an hour, with higher pay for skilled work. Governmental hiring terms included preference to veterans and no hiring of Asians. The Colored Citizens Labor and Protective Association of Las Vegas protested de facto hiring discrimination against blacks. Their eventual representation among the employed totaled an estimated 24 to to 30 for the duration of the project. A few Native Americans were hired as high scalers to remove loose rock with jackhammers and dynamite. Estimated fatalities ranged from 96 to over 150. Many died from falls, heat-related illnesses, falling debris, heavy equipment, and carbon monoxide poisoning from tunnel work. The project was rocked by at least 2 documented strikes. The industrial workers of the world attempted to organize there. Workers struck over wage cuts and working conditions. They repeatedly demanded flushing toilets and cold, clean running water, especially in temperatures as high as 120 degrees in the summertime. At the time the Hoover Dam was turned over to the federal government, it was the tallest dam and the largest hydroelectric station in the country. It currently generates about 4 billion kilowatt hours of hydroelectric power for Nevada, Arizona, and California. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. About 25% of the Environmental Protection Agency's budget is being cut by Trump. Approximately 3,000 EPA jobs will be cut, going from 15,000 down to a staff of 12,000. John O'Grady is president of AFGE's National Council of EPA Locals, the largest union representing EPA workers.
Morale is in the basement, possibly lower. We're already at a point where we don't have enough staff to do everything that Congress has tasked us with. And to reduce the staff by another 3,000 is going to make it impossible for US EPA to protect human health and the environment. They're going to cut climate change activities. They're going to cut waters of the United States. If you like to fish, if you like to just enjoy nature, that may impact your ability to have those enjoyments.
O'Grady says federal enforcement capacity and standards are also endangered by these cuts. That would lead to different environmental standards and enforcement by the states, rather than having a uniform national standard for environmental protection.
It's too easy for a plant manager to say to the governor, hey, look, get these guys off my back. I bring 10,000 jobs to this state. Do you want me to leave? And so what's the governor going to do? Is he going to say no, that EPA regulation is going to stay in place? No, he's going to loosen it.
Instead of trying to improve EPA's environmental protection mission, the Trump administration is attacking, dismantling, and suppressing it. O'Grady says the bullying at EPA includes attacking AFGE, the largest union representing EPA workers.
Going after our dues deductions, automatic payroll deductions, they're doing a number of other things that will inhibit us from continuing to represent. That's the kind of thing that sends a chilling effect throughout the agency, so that people think, okay, you don't mess with these guys, I'll lose my job. I've got a family, I've got a house mortgage, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, people are keeping their heads down. There's no question we're under attack.
A coalition, including the National Consumers League, is launching a campaign urging consumers to close Wells Fargo bank accounts until forced arbitration requirements are dropped. Forced arbitration prevents consumers from taking Wells Fargo to court. The coalition says it's targeting Wells Fargo Bank over its illegal practices and to protect consumer rights to hold businesses accountable in court. National Consumers League Executive Director Sally Greenberg says her organization pulled money from Wells Fargo and instead put it in the Bank of Labor. She says the Bank of Labor has a very fair agreement for depositors with no forced arbitration clause.
Brought to you by Blue Cross Blue Shield National Labor Office, empowering working Americans with stable health coverage for over 50 years. The National Labor Office is committed to remaining the top choice for the 17 million union workers, retirees, and families they serve. Online at bcbs.com/NLO.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Oprah Winfrey for president? In an interview today, Oprah admitted she is considering a run for the White House. She explained that she had not thought it would be possible given her lack of military or political experience, but after Trump's election, she began to reconsider. Winfrey may not have professional experience, but she has not shied away from sharing her opinions. She endorsed Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton without campaigning for her and did several appearances with Barack Obama during his first campaign, the first time she had endorsed a candidate.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jenny Okuyama and Dan Raphael. Our producer is Ray Bodwell, David Kesters is our engineer. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zillah Sales Marchant. And the Evening Public Affairs Director is Ken Schlesinger. We have split those two. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. And you can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Voices from the Edge with Joanne Hardesty. Call in and join the conversation. At 9, it's Press Watch, your weekly counter-propaganda left opinion program. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, we welcome scholar Stephen Cohen to discuss the allegations of Trump's Kremlin connections. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Between the Covers welcomes the author of A Really Good Day, and she shares her personal experiment of microdosing with LSD. And at 11:30, Black Book Talk reviews works from well-known and emerging authors. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're a current member, or if you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station.
It's 5:40 on a Wednesday, and as always, that means it is time for News from the Boo, our weekly roundup of items of interest here at the station and in the greater listening community. We've got a full house tonight. We are being joined this evening by Gil Cardone, who is one of our station co-managers, and also we have joining us tonight Selena Chow, who may be our most frequent guest on News from the Boo at this point. She is our National Digital Stewardship resident from the American Archive of Public Broadcasting. So, Selena, we'll start with you because we want to get an update on what you've been up to since the last time we spoke. So let's rewind first and describe for us, when did you join KBOO as the stewardship resident?
I've been KBOO's digital stewardship resident since the end of July, which seems like a long time ago. The time has just been flying by. And I've been here working to build frameworks and workflows that will support digital preservation of news and public affairs audio content. For example, one goal is to inform the community that digitization alone is not the same as digital preservation. When an organization is committed to digital preservation, it means that the files and information about the digital resources are created according to workflows that ensure the best quality and best representation of cultural heritage material, and that the information is consistent and accurate, that information is monitored over time, and that there is a plan for access of the materials into the future.
Can you describe one of those workflows, or what a workflow would look like that would achieve these goals?
Sure. So we do some digitization in-house, and then we also send out items to a vendor, some of our more fragile materials where we know that the vendor takes care of their equipment and is more suited for doing digitization on a bulk of materials that we send them. So when we digitize in-house, sometimes people want information right away, and that's great. And there's different ways to digitize materials. But to digitize in a high-level quality audio, we prefer a sample rate of like 96 kilohertz. We have bits of like 24 bits for WAV files. We collect different metadata, which is information about when it was created, the digital file, and in addition to when it was originally broadcast or recorded. We make sure that information stays the same over time. We often use an algorithm to ensure that the bits in the file stay the same when it's being transferred from place to place. So when we have in-house digitization, we use different softwares. There's some really great ones out there. I think a lot of digital archivists use open source technology because it helps automate some processes, and the technology can be built upon when there's a community around it. But anyways, one of these open source softwares is called Media Info, and we can find out the details of a file, even if I'm going back and checking information from past digitization to see the quality of the file. There's different information about the file that shows up in the fields there. We also use a program called FFmpeg, which creates an MP3 file for listening off of the WAV file, so that our WAV file is a preservation file. It goes into a storage place that is consistently monitored for, you know, being up and running and making sure the file doesn't change. Am I going into the weeds and describing this workflow?
Not to me, certainly.
Okay, great. I'm glad you're following along. So there's different pieces of information that goes into the process. We document different things on a technical level, on a descriptive level, and take care of the files in a certain way using various software programs.
So talk to us a little bit about how this project was funded.
Sure. So I've been on the program News from the Boo for a couple times, and I described how this program that I'm here is funded by a grant by the IMLS, which is the Institute for Museum and Library Services. And the NDSR program, the National Digital Stewardship Residency Program, is organized and overseen by the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. So the NDSR programs have multiple cohorts. So I'm in the cohort that is working now with public broadcasting materials. There have been previous NDSR programs. All of them relate to preserving digital heritage content in the United States. So there have been ones, there's ones just starting about art. There's things about science data and biodiversity, digital information. There have been geographically connected ones, like cohorts in Washington, D.C. There's one